Welcome to Attempting Murder Podcast, a safe space for personal gnosis. Attempting Murder is a monthly podcast reverently dedicated to the Morrigan. We come not only as crow women, but as spiritual humans making sense of and finding meaning in our lives. We hope you will join us as we meet in this space to commune with each other and build connection with the greater community.
If you have comments, questions, or just want to show your support to this podcast, please feel free to follow us on Twitter at AttemptingMurd1. Join us at our blog at AttemptingMurderPodcast.wordpress.com or emailing us directly at AttemptingMurderPodcast@gmail.com. This podcast is available at anchor.fm/AttemptingMurder and other regular podcast outlets. If you enjoy Attempting Murder, please hit the subscribe and like buttons wherever you find us.
Our intro music is titled Realm of Hope, composed by Jonathan Segev. You can find this song and many other gorgeous pieces by checking out his YouTube channel. Please check our show notes for a link.
Hello, and welcome to Attempting Murder. This is episode 3, December 26, 2019. And this is our Yule and New Moon episode. Try as we might have to embrace the Philo part of the year for my counterparts here, Willow and River, it has hardly been that. As those of you who've been listening a while will note, Willow was mid-move last we met and is still sort of suffering the post-move hangover where furniture ordered came late, and storage units had to be plundered and their contents needed to be filled into new space. So she is not available to be with us. And River has had her own challenges. She's been learning a new way of parenting as a single parent and co-parenting with her soon-to-be, well, eventually to be ex-husband. And also trying to get used to and enjoy a first job in some while since she's been a stay-at-home mom and now she's become a working mom. So between all of those things and the joys and challenges of treating and enjoying a life with three exceptional children through the holidays, she also was not able to get together with me. So despite our best intentions, we did not indeed get a Yule episode together, but instead I find myself here to offer up something, however meager, to our fledgling audience and to mark the spinning of the wheel. In preparation for this episode, I had a ton of ideas about in my head, though I had my own difficulties nailing it down to an important few threads, at least until it fell to me to do this solo, which, God has forgive me, I am going to try to do. In the year 2000, my best friend in life, Fand, and I'm using her craft name here, and my then husband, Everthorn, also using his craft name, and myself traveled to Ireland in the month of May. We spent 14 days in a rented pea green Fiat Punto, and we drove Widdershins basically around the Isle. And while we were there and staying in Dublin, our first few days in Ireland, we went to Newgrange and got a chance to see up close and personal this pre-Celtic monolith, right? And really got an opportunity to experience the importance of the solstices and the equinoxes on our very ancient ancestors, even be they pre-Celtic. That particular earthwork was built pre-Celtic invasion, and it had, you know, we got to go inside. So it had a center chamber with a bold stone, which, if I remember correctly from the guide, they said that human and animal remains were found in it. And at the time, it was still believed that it was just basically a big burial mound, but they've come since then, through more archaeological work, to realize that it was a very large temple. But while we were inside that center chamber, they have a simulation light that they use to show you what it looks like on winter solstice. And that whole, the way that thing was built was so perfect to funnel the sunrise right down this top chamber along the ceiling and into that centered chamber. It filled it with this beautiful, warm glow. And to me, it seemed so obvious what the symbolism of rebirth was to that, like exactly what they must have been thinking. That life, death, and rebirth cycle that is so common in Celtic mythology. For me, it was a really fantastic experience. And I was completely surprised, I guess, by learning how it was built, that they made bold boats, which were hides stretched over bent saplings, and floated rocks from as far away as Donegal, all the way to Meath, to Brunaboyne, which is the complex of other earthworks, pre-Celtic elf earthworks, that are with New Grange in that area. It was amazing to me. And then more so amazing to me to realize that the people that originally started building that mound were not going to live to see it finished. And in fact, didn't. The lifespan of folks in that area at that time was about 40 years of age at the fullest. And it took three times that to complete it entirely. So it was a real labor of love for this community, and the only kind of edifice you can imagine that would be made for a god, that people would do this and commit so much of their life and their resources to the erection of this and know that they could plan it, but they would never see it in use fully, see it completed. So it's an amazing act of faith, a leap of faith, and a complete belief in that idea of rebirth, that this physical body that I make this monument with my hands now may not see that, but the next life I will. So it's just an amazing place. And for folks who ever get a chance to go to Ireland, I really suggest that you go there. We do know that in Celtic myth, New Grange is the home and seat of the Dagda, and that it is kind of the perfect place for him. When we think about that life, death, and rebirth cycle, and we think about his cauldron, it's easy to see where the Celts would incorporate that entirely into their belief system and see that for what it was, that it was Dagda's place, a place where we go into the other world and return life into death and into life again. When it comes to my own observation of the holiday, the plans I had for Yule this year were kind of thwarted by this wandering about in a sort of labyrinth of my own thoughts. Perhaps I could see this time as contemplation and a form of gestational work. I didn't really attend any event, although I had it in mind that I would, because I had on summer solstice. But I just sort of lit a candle and sung up the sun and thought about, you know, the souls crossing over and how in some ways I feel the same, that I am in that earth and waiting for something, waiting to bloom. I don't know how else to explain that, but I've talked about it before. And for some of you who've read some of the things I've posted on our WordPress blog, I'm really struggling and have been really struggling to come back from a place of pretty interruptive and pretty profound depression and physical illness that really robbed me of just my will to be spiritual or to feel much. And I'm trying to fight back from that because I realize that it's something that really, really matters to me, my spirituality. And I am finally in a place emotionally and physically where I feel like I have the strength to get back in that flow and to really work. And I was concerned, and I still am, on and off, that I've let my relationship to the Morgan wane to the point where all I really was doing was sort of muttering to her when things were good and muttering to her when things were bad, and not really putting much walk behind my talk. So, you know, the legs of this year have kind of like carried me to this place, and I'm starting to feel that groggy stirring of spirit. My monthly work with River and Willow is like a blast of, you know, delicious coffee aroma, and it does tease me to spiritual wakefulness, and of a sort that I have just not enjoyed in a really long time. But between times, I'm still struggling with keeping engaged, and I feel like I'm lagging and stumbling. I make plans to do things, and then I break them. It almost feels like I'm like sleepwalking through it all. So, you know, I've concocted like these three different schemes to get myself more involved and more connected, if nothing else, to the Morgan. But I keep falling back into that old pattern of just muttering to her, and instead of making the effort of prayer and reverence. So tonight I plan on doing a new moon thing all by myself, and I've set aside the time and the space to engage. So it's not going to be any, you know, muttered thoughts tonight. I'm not going to get out the tarot and vet questions at her, but I am going to go out into the cold, and I'm going to walk down to the Mississippi, and I am going to take a bucket with me, and I'm going to fill that bucket with icy cold water, and I am going to dunk my head in it. If I could jump in there, I would, but I don't think it's safe right now. There's ice in places, and it can be very dangerous in the wintertime, but I'm going to get that bucket of water and kind of give myself a cleansing and renewal and a shock. I'm hoping that it's just sort of all of the above. I feel like I need to dunk my often way too heated intellect and let it kind of wash over me, this bracing, you know, human moment. I feel very strongly about that. So this is sort of part of my plan for this evening. I also have engaged to do a reading for a friend tonight who is a baby pagan and needs a little guidance. So he's been working on some spell work for since last new moon under my guidance. And tonight I'm going to do a reading for him, but that will be before I go and do my thing outside. In preparation for all of this too, I've been giving poetry a lot of thought. I used to write all the time. And when I lived in Milwaukee, I used to go to a poetry reading every Monday and share my poetry and think about words. I just used to write poetry a lot more often. And I've always been a poetry writer, just a person who plots things down in a notebook, sometimes to share with people, but most oftentimes not. I got more into doing that after I moved to Milwaukee. But at any rate, I've been thinking a lot about poetry. And, you know, when I used to write all the rhyme and spell stuff for my Book of Shadows, and I used to write the liturgy for rituals when I did things in group with friends of mine, that was really important to me. So I started thinking about how that relates to what I'm doing now, and also thinking about if that's something that I can really engage the Morgan with more so, especially considering, you know, she herself did prophetic poetry and spoke, you know, in rhyme. I've been thinking about how that might interface with what I'm working on, and it gives me something to chew on intellectually, to build on as an understanding of my path and that power of words and the thinking about the images that words conjure, which is also part of our, you know, power and our energy, right? When we're setting intentions for things, and even when we're giving praise to the gods, it's all wrapped up in that, the imagery of our words and how we say a thing. So I've been looking into some of the old forms of Celtic poetry, and I kind of been like doing school kid exercises by like using the forms and trying to write something out. At any rate, I'm just kind of hoping to, you know, use the dusty rocks of my dulled imagination and like set them, you know, in these forms and see if I can learn what the art feels like, relearn what the art feels like and looks like and sounds like. So my two offerings I figured I'd share with you guys. And the first one is a failed attempt at a Shayna. Now, it's failed because I didn't finish with the same word I started. I think the rest of the form is fairly in there, but after I got it done, I realized that I messed that part up. So, but it's called Exile. Off trail my sore spirit wandered, distant from her hearth I crept, soul split and blind, this heart keening, key in keeping, I only wept. And then the second one is for tonight, and I can't pronounce the form properly, but it's Trian Reinechta Moore. And this poem's called Petitioning. Dark moon or snow, past solstice tide, yet hills still glow where phantoms abide. Lonesome I walk, my feet traipse through land white as chalk, over hill to slough. The water's edge ahead, my chill arms aloft, with Niven I plead, my frosty words waft. As icy shadow breath, pale-faced I hark, asking for strength to face my dark. Now, they're both pretty humble, stumbling little things, but one has to start somewhere, I suppose. I just hope and pray that the Morrigan will forgive me my infantile mutterings. But coming around again, I have also taken the time to ponder my beginnings. To muse about the early days and at what point I may have first encountered the Morrigan. There are certain things that happen to us, even as children, that we remember, you know, with like absolute clarity. But for whatever reason, it takes decades sometimes for them to fall into place and their importance to become really clear to us. I would suggest that things with the Morrigan are very much like that, or at least they have been for me. You know, prophecy is one of her functions. It's just one of the many strands woven into her raiment. One such event as this took place when I was in my late childhood or early tweens. I can't say for sure how old I was exactly, but I was old enough to understand the power of a good swear and to know to not use those words, at least not yet. The language of adulthood wasn't yet mine to wield, you know? However, it was a fine spring morning that I do remember, and somewhere between the frost kisses of early April and the hot of mid-June, my recollection of it is that I was out of school, which could have been either a weekend or after the first week of June. Either way, it was early. The sun was up, just peeking over the shoulders of the shagbark hickory grove that circled our house. My room was on the second floor, or half floor. Actually, our home was one of those fake Cape Cod houses built in the early 1920s. So I had a dormered ceiling and I only had one window in my room, and it was on the eastern side of the house. And outside and just below my window, there was a top of a older lilac shrub. Although it was so tall, it might as well have been a tree at that point. And it was with no leaves on it. So it was that early in spring. And just the soft buds of leaves. And in the, you know, sweet Wisconsin morning, in those buds rest a crow. a very big, fat, glossy, and noisy crow. And I, you know, was laying in and enjoying sleeping in that morning. And then this crow started to caw. And I mean, like, loud, demanding, raucous caws, like right in my window. And I had, you know, at that point, no idea that they had such big lungs or could make so much noise. It woke me. And I grumbled and pulled my pillow over my head and tried to ignore it, but there was no chance of that. The bawling and the barking caw just continued on and on and on. And finally, after I stuffed my fingers in my ears and realized I couldn't sleep that away, I got out of bed. Now, a steamy temper runs in my family. And having been woken up on a day I didn't have to get up for either chores or school put me on the wrong side of the bed, as we say here. My feet landed on my carpet and I stomped over to the window and I opened it. Now, it was closed, but it was still that loud. So this crow was like literally like from my nose to my computer screen a distance from the window and just screaming in it. And so I threw open that window and the sound of opening the window, like the motion or the sound, none of it scared that crow away. It just stayed there. So when I had the window open and I literally pressed my nose to the screen, and the crow was like a foot away, and I just yelled at it. Like I just leaned forward and I cut my hands, you know, around my mouth, and I said the F word. I told it to shut the blank up. And apparently that worked because the crow just kind of looked at me with both black and shiny eyes for a minute and then cawed one more time and then flapped up and out of the lilac and it went to the rest of one of the hickory trees and screamed down the hill behind our house at something or someone else. The fun part that my dad even still remembers this event was because after the crow was away and it was quieter, I could hear my dad laughing downstairs in my mom and dad's bedroom was right under mine. So he heard me use the F word and tell that crow to shut up. I'm guessing the crow had woken him too. So this was a mutual response. But for all the times I've told my story about the call of the Morgan and how it came and how I answered, I rarely recount this part of it. I feel as if it's fair to place it in the realm of UPG. That said, sometime in the mid-90s, while I was floundering and flirting with several Celtic deities between Bridget and Caradwyn and Caeliac, I picked up a novel called The Red Branch by Morgan Llewellyn. And when I began to read it, I came across a passage that really resonated with me. And I mean, resonated me with so strongly that I had to put the book down and kind of sit with this wash of feelings that came over me. That passage is in total about 2.5-3 pages, but I'm going to just read you the beginning and then read you the end. So here it is. When winter's mud gave birth to flowers, Satanta began wandering further and further from the fort. Watch the boy, but don't interfere with him, the captain of the guard instructed his men. Remember how it was for you. Growing boys need to go off by themselves sometimes. Dectra did not seem to be troubled by her son's absences. Her thoughts were elsewhere. She would be happier if I were elsewhere too, Satanta told himself sadly. The realization made him feel like crying, but he had recently decided to be too old to cry. A plan began forming itself inside him. Ignoring the northern road that led openly to Imenmaha, he began using the southern gate instead, the one the herders used. When departing for the day on one of his rambles, he took his little sword and his spears and his beloved hurley stick and a spare cloak and a packet of bread and cheese. He made certain that the guards got used to seeing all of this. Well provisioned, he would wander a whole day on the plain of Methenmi, teaching himself to find his way in an unfamiliar place. Southwest of the fort, he discovered a rough-surfaced gray pillar stone alone in a field, like a giant's accusing finger pointed at the sky. No man other than a druid would touch a standing stone, a memorial to a vanished race of unknown powers. The second time Satanta happened upon that stone, a huge raven was perched atop it. The bird did not fly away at his approach, but seemed to wait for him, unblinking. It regarded him with a predator's glare. Satanta thought of the battle raven, the dreaded Morrigan, who was one of the deities of war. Her name was to be whispered with horror, for in her guise as the bird, the Morrigan haunted battlefields, inciting carnage and feasting afterwards on carrion. The boy was seized by a defiant sense of play. He drew his sword and ran forward, brandishing his weapon. "Hail to the Morrigan!" he cried, tossing back his hair and laughing. "I will be the greatest of all your warriors. Watch me!" He flung the sword into the air, spinning up, up, bird and boy watching it together until it dropped, and he caught it with a deft turn of his wrist just in front of the pillar stone. The raven did not move until the sword was back in Satanta's hand, and then she opened her wings. Their cold shadow fell across his upturned face. Satanta's playful mood evaporated. He walked away from the pillar stone and sought other areas to explore, thereafter avoiding the field where it stood. Now, just a little further on, there's a little more exposition, but we get to the day where Satanta sets out to leave for Emain Maha, and he is planning on joining the boys' troop, which is the sons of Connor McNess's warrior band, the Red Branch. Noticing a broad, clear pool a little distant from the road, Satanta paused to drink and bathe himself. Dirt and sweat had mingled on his skin in one pervasive itch. He was almost finished when he heard a sound like a cough. He glanced up to see a raven sitting on the stump of a tree watching him. A glossy, arrogant raven, like the bird on the pillar stone. With a show of indifference, he turned his back on the bird and put on his clothes. When he was back on the road, he heard the dry rattle of feathers overhead and looked up to see the bird flying above him, going the same direction. It circled and dropped lower. He could see its outsized, cruel bill. "You're only a bird," Satanta shouted at it, refusing to be intimidated. "Just feathers and bones. I'm a warrior's son, and I am not afraid of you." It's here in this telling of Cuchulainn's life that we're made to understand that the Morrigan chose him, and that on that day, at that stone, he made his oath and sealed his fate for good or ill. I don't fancy myself a hero. I would never suggest my own name in the same sentence with the likes of Cuchulainn or Fionn or any of the great heroes. But the similarity between my own reaction to that crow on that spring morning and Satanta's were hard to ignore. I can't say if that morning I marked myself or was chosen, but to think on it gives a certain gravity to the rest of my life and to the choices I have made for good or ill, the ways in which I have molded myself and been molded by others, and the passage of time. Most certainly, that morning sits in the fore of my mind as I prepare myself for renewing my oath to her on this dark moon. Now, if you've stuck with me thus far into the episode, I promise not to keep you over long, but there are two more things I'd like to discuss briefly before I close up the episode. And the first is a bit of fangirly shout-out to one of the writers at Pathios, John Beckett. John has written a plethora of fantastic articles on the Morrigan and his service to her, which have really and truly spoken to me. In my quest to renew my relationship to her, I first came across his post entitled, "Sometimes the Gods Take What They Want, and Sometimes What They Want Is You." And now I have soaked nearly all the rest of them up which I have to say has been heartening and encouraging. It is my intention this evening to borrow heavily from two of his posts, a ritual to remove curses we place on ourselves and an oath to the Morrigan. For so long, I have hidden under my rock and pushed away that twilight spark, pushed it away with negative self-talk and denial, allowing my illness to control me instead of the other way around. And over the years, it sort of built a callus and perhaps a curse. One of the first things we learn on this path is that words are power. What we say with intention is magic. And so running ourselves down, even when it is privately, eventually becomes a cord of binding that we're caught in. And I'm tired of being sick and tired. I am exhausted with the emptiness, and I know that my best times in life were when I was engaged spiritually and magically, when I felt and honored on a daily basis that tie between myself and the Morrigan. So I just want to shout out to John Beckett and thank him for his wisdom and his honesty as he too walked this path, has struggled, and given himself to her service. His story has been an inspiration to me, and made clear to me that it is never too late to do the right thing, too late to repair what is broken, and that the rewards are often surpassing of the pain it takes to get there. Now, to wrap up this episode, I'd like to speak for a moment on forgiveness, context, and cancel culture. This week has seen more than a few folks reeling over tweets made by a famous author who has outed themselves as a trans-exclusionary feminist. So, I feel like it is a timely topic and one that I'd like to address both in the context of paganism and our personal lives. Most pagans, of whatever flavor, enjoy a good story. And storytelling is a device of redemption, and it is often used. It is a sort of story where the character who we see as good falls, is disgraced, and later emerges after many trials to reclaim our support through a redemptive arc. Well, this doesn't just happen in stories. It happens too in real life. It happens to celebrities. It happens to family members, to coworkers, and even to ourselves. We become invested in these stories because they offer us a carrot of our own redemption, should we ever find ourselves reduced. Now, there's also been a lot of talk in pagan circles about Isaac Bonewits and the ADF, particularly in regards to their apparent or tacit approval of the man after allegations that he was involved in the sexual abuse of a minor. In this day and age, post Me Too, it is hard for a lot of us to see the rationale of or support the decision to wait and see when it comes to these sorts of allegations. We are encouraged to support the victim regardless and to shun or vilify the accused. I don't want to comment on that beyond saying that sexual assault and abuse happen all the time to people of every age, every gender, every sex, and every socioeconomic bracket. Sexual assault and abuse is not a focused problem. It's endemic. And in that regard, we all have to take these sorts of allegations seriously. When we encounter them in our peer groups, our religious groups, our workplaces, and our public life, and our home life, we have to take them seriously. Isaac Bonewits is a case of this, but in reverse. He's dead now and can't stand against these accusations. And while his legacy is troublesome to a lot of people who see him as a polluted influence on ADF and paganism in general, I've read ADF's statement about Isaac, and while I understand their position and the position of others that these allegations are serious, that the possibility that they are true puts ADF in retrospect in a tough position. I have a difficult time wrestling with the idea that these people didn't know that Isaac was problematic. I met Isaac at an ADF function sometime in the late 90s or early 2000s. I was really excited to meet him. I held him in exceptionally high esteem. I had been nursed as a baby witch, Wiccan pagan person, on Margot Adler's Drawing Down the Moon. This ADF event I attended was put on by a then very close friend of mine who was trying to establish and support her own active proto-grove. And having someone like Isaac and the then Archdruid, I don't remember this person's name specifically, but they were both in attendance, and it was a big deal. I went to support her efforts. I went to see what ADF was like, to see the large group in action and to mingle with other pagans. But I also went because I was super excited to meet Isaac Bonowitz, who was kind of a hero to me. But my meeting with Isaac left me less than impressed and very disappointed. While he didn't sexually assault me, he was inappropriate. He suggested to me that, and I mean immediately upon introducing myself, that I come out east and study under him, and with a kind of a tongue-in-cheek and not very cheeky grin on his face. It really kind of melted the feet of the pedestal I put him on. I expected him to be priestly and professional and not like a creeper uncle, which he kind of was. His further rantings and musings over the course of the weekend kind of left me with the impression that he was fairly full of himself, more than a touch misogynistic. And it was likely good that by this time he'd been made emeritus instead of still being the main representation of ADF. While I found him repellent, the final activity of the two-day event was an ADF rite during which Isaac sang his song to the Morrigan. I have to say, it left me feeling some kind of way. While I saw him as a base and rather unsavory person, I could not deny the power of that verse that he'd written, nor the energy with which he sang it. I could not ignore how my own spirit felt those words, or how the Morrigan's energy and power filled that room as a result. That all happened, channeled through her imperfect priest. Isaac is problematic. Many human beings are. Nearly every one of us has opinions, habits or interests that others would find offensive, and reasons enough to cancel us and our work. We may not want to hear that or even be honest about it, but that doesn't make it less true. Cancel culture, when adopted and used both actively with living beings and retroactively with the dead, robs us, the subject, and the world of the possibility of redemption and encourages the purposeful ignorance when we refuse to read their books, to sing their songs, or investigate their work. We, as human beings, are not just our dysfunctions, but our functions too. And if we wish for space in this world to grow and learn and redeem ourselves, when we need to remain open to that in others and not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't hold ADF responsible for Isaac's behavior. I don't think they handled it right. But then, who hasn't made mistakes of this sort in their life? I am glad to hear that they are going to do better, try to do better. But I also think it's a great loss to strike him from the organization as if he didn't exist, as if his faith wasn't their cornerstone. I think when things like this happen, we're all a little diminished by the result. That may be a kind of unpopular opinion, but I don't know that any opinions around issues like this are ever going to be fully popular. This is something that modern life requires of us to make sense of. It isn't just in paganism. Plenty of other social groups, religious groups, political groups, etc., struggle with this. And we could go the route of some and say that it doesn't matter, or devalue the victim, or devalue any segment of the population to which the victimization in these circumstances falls. But that doesn't get us anywhere. And we could just believe every single thing that's ever said and deny ourselves valuable things. I mean, we all know things about Thomas Jefferson that, despite the fact that he was a framer of the Constitution and a leading mind of his time, people suggest we should cancel him because we found out since he died terrible things, or our view on slavery has changed to the point where we see him as a monster. Except if we do that, what happens to the Louisiana Purchase? What happens to air conditioning? What happens to the Constitution? Really? I mean, really? So, people are complex, and nobody's 100% perfect, and nobody's 100% pure. Purity tests and litmus tests for people's lives and how they interact in the community is dangerous, slippery slope, in my opinion. And I don't like making slippery slope arguments, but I think it needs to be said. I still appreciate that Isaac Bonowitz created ADF. It might not be my path, but I know it works for a lot of people. My friend still has her Proto-Grove. I know the rest of the people that I met at that gathering were really terrific. I learned a lot at that gathering, which was really nice. And for the closing ritual, Isaac singing that song really spoke to me, regardless of how I felt about him, which was, ew. And then to hear that this other stuff happened, or allegedly happened with fairly good indication it's true, also, ew. Worse than you. He was a criminal. But I don't want to cancel that event because he was there in my head. And I don't want to cancel that song that he wrote because of what happened. It doesn't change that. But what it does prove is that we all have to be vigilant, and it can be anybody. That we don't all know what a person is just by looking at them. That there are truths that are deeper. And it's up to us to see them. And it's also up to us to remember that we are the sum of all that we do. And our good and our bad are not like scales. Unless you're, an Egyptian practitioner, no one's going to weigh your soul against the weight of a feather. So we have to take these things and integrate them into the complex understandings that we have of people in our movement, the leaders of our movement, and our future leaders of this movement, and our current leaders of this movement. It's not simple. And it's not simple with people like J.K. Rowling either. It's not simple. It's complicated. And it's okay to be on both sides of the fence at the same time on this issue. And it's okay to be frustrated and need to work through it. It's okay. I have the same feeling about it. But it does make me a little sad that in reaction to having not taken action before, that's what ADF decided to do. It's pretty disappointing. So, anyway, that is all I have for you guys for this week, for this month. Wish us luck for the new moon next month. Next weekend, I think me and River, but it might just end up being me, or it might be me and Willow, or it might be all three of us. I'm not sure. Everyone's schedule is so crazy, but we are going to be appearing on Flatline to Beatline. So if you have any special questions you want answered about any of us, you should definitely send them through PM or DM to Flatline to Beatline. And because we won't have a theme or anything, we'll just be talking. Just answering questions, being interviewed. So, and if you haven't checked out that podcast already, I really suggest it. Follow them on Twitter. It's really good. I've enjoyed it. I think it'll be an interesting conversation. The questions are almost always really good and relevant. So I'm excited. Also to get a little push. And that's that. So I hope that you guys will stick around and hear us next month when we will be doing just a new moon program. And that's it. By then, the girls will be back. Please, I hope. It's been nuts. Everybody's been so busy. I, on the other hand, am not quite so busy. So that's why you got stuck with me. Anyway, until then, safe travels to you and yours. And may the Morrigan be ever on your shoulder.
Attempting Murder is a monthly podcast reverently dedicated to the Morrigan.
If you have comments, questions, or just want to show your support to this podcast, please feel free to follow us on Twitter at AttemptingMurd1. Join us at our blog at AttemptingMurderPodcast.wordpress.com or emailing us directly at AttemptingMurderPodcast@gmail.com. This podcast is available at anchor.fm/attemptingmurder and other regular podcast outlets. If you enjoy Attempting Murder, please hit the subscribe and like buttons wherever you find us.